Chapter 50 Chasing the Wind. I gave my admissions tile to Fela, telling her I hoped it brought her luck. And so the winter term came to an end. Suddenly, 3/4 of my life simply disappeared. I had no classes to occupy my time, no shifts in the medica to fill. I could no longer check out materials from stocks, use tools in the fishery, or enter the archives. At first it wasn't so bad. The midwinter pageantry was wonderfully distracting, and without the worry of work and study I was free to enjoy myself and spend time in the company of my friends. Then spring term started. My friends were still there, but they were busy with their own studies. I found myself crossing the river more and more. Denner was still nowhere to be found, but Diok and Stanchion were always willing to share a drink and some idle gossip. Threep was there too, and while he occasionally pressed me to attend a dinner at his house, I could tell his heart wasn't in it. My trial hadn't pleased people on this side of the river either, and they were still telling stories about it. I wouldn't be welcome in any respectable social circle for a great long time, if ever. I toyed with the idea of leaving the university. I knew people would forget about the trial more quickly if I wasn't around, but where would I go? The only thought that came to mind was heading off to Ill with the vain hope of finding Denner. But I knew that was nothing but foolishness. Since I didn't need to save money for tuition, I went to repay Devi. But for the first time ever, I wasn't able to find her. Over the course of several days, I grew increasingly nervous. I even slid several apologetic notes under her door until I heard from Mola that she was taking a holiday and would be returning soon. Days passed, and I sat idle as winter slowly withdrew from the university. Frost left the corners of window panes, drifts of snow dwindled, and trees began to show their first greening buds. Eventually, Simon caught his first glimpse of bare leg beneath a flowing dress and declared spring had officially arrived. One afternoon, as I sat drinking metheglin with Stanchion, Threep came through the door practically bubbling with excitement. He whisked me off to a private table on the second tier, looking ready to burst with whatever news he was carrying. Threep folded his hands on the tabletop.
Since we haven't had much luck finding your local patron, I started casting my nets farther afield. It's nice to have a local patron, but if you have the support of a properly influential lord, it hardly matters where he lives.
I nodded. My troop had ranged all over the Four Corners under the protection of Lord Greyfellow's name. Threep grinned.
Have you ever been to Winter's?
Possibly, I said. Then seeing his puzzled look, I explained. I travelled quite a bit when I was young. I can't remember if we ever made it that far east. He nodded.
Do you know who the Mayor Alvaron is?
I did, but I could tell Threep was bursting to tell me himself. I seem to remember something, I said vaguely. Threep grinned.
You know the expression, rich as the king of Vint?
I nodded.
Well, that's him. His great-great-grandfathers were the kings of Vint back before the Empire stomped in, converting everyone to the Iron Law and the Book of the Path. If not for a few quirks of fate a dozen generations back, Alvaron would be the royal family of Vintus, not the Calanthes, and my friend the mayor would be the king.
Your friend, I said appreciatively. You know Mayor Alvaron? Threep made a vacillating gesture.
Friend, maybe, stretching things a little, he admitted. We've been corresponding for some years, exchanging news from our different corners of the world, doing each other a favour or two. It would be more appropriate to say we're acquainted.
An impressive acquaintance. What's he like?
His letters are quite polite. Never a bit snobby, even though he does stand quite a good rank above me, Threep said modestly. He's every bit a king except for the title and crown, you know. When Vintus formed, his family refused to surrender any of their plenary powers. That means Mayor has the authority to do most anything King Roderick himself can do. Grant titles, raise an army, coin money, levy taxes.
Threep shook his head sharply.
Oh, I forgot what I'm doing,
he said as he began to search his pockets.
Ah, I received a letter from him only yesterday.
He produced a piece of paper, unfolded it, then cleared his throat and read.
I know you are knee-deep in poets and musicians out there, and I'm rather in need of a young man who is good with words. I cannot find anyone to suit me here in Severn, and everything said I would prefer the best. He should be good with words above all, perhaps a musician of some sort. Mm-hmm. After that, I would desire him to be clever, well-spoken, mannerly, educated, and discreet. On reading this list, you may see why I have had no luck finding such a one for myself. If you happen to know a man of this rare sort, encourage him to call on me. I would tell you what use I intend to put him to, but the matter is of a private nature.
Threep studied the letter for a moment or two.
It goes on for a bit, then he says, as to the matter I mentioned before, I am in some haste. If there is no one suitable in Imre, please send me a letter by post. If you happen to send someone my way, encourage him to make speed.
Threep's eyes scanned the paper for a moment more, his lips moving silently.
That's all of it,
he said finally, and tucked it back into a pocket.
What do you think?
You do me a great...
Yes, yes,
he waved a hand impatiently.
You're flattered, skip all that.
He leaned forward seriously.
Will you do it? Will your studies...
He made a dismissive gesture westward toward the university.
Permit an absence of a season or so.
I cleared my throat.
I've actually been considering taking my studies abroad for a time.
The Count burst into a wide grin and thumped the arm of his chair.
Good!
He laughed.
I thought I was going to have to pry you out of your precious university like a penny from a dead chim's fist. This is a wonderful opportunity, you realise. Once in a lifetime, really.
He gave me a sly wink.
Besides, a young man like yourself would be hard-pressed to find a better patron than a man who's richer than the King of Vint.
There's some truth to that, I admitted aloud. Silently, I thought, could I hope for better assistance in my search for the Amir?
There's much truth to that,
he chuckled.
How soon can you be ready to leave?
I shrugged. Tomorrow? Threep raised an eyebrow.
You don't give much time for the dust to settle, do you?
He said he was in haste, and I'd rather be early than late.
True, true.
He drew a silver gear watch from his pocket, looked at it, then sighed as he clicked it closed.
I'll have to miss some sleep tonight drafting a letter of introduction for you.
I glanced at the window. It's not even dark yet, I said. How long do you expect it to take?
Hush,
he said crossly.
I write slowly, especially when I'm sending a letter to someone as important as the mayor. Plus, I have to describe you. No easy task by itself.
Let me help you then, I said. No sense losing sleep on my account. I smiled. Besides, if there's one thing I'm well versed in, it's my own good qualities. The next day, I made a round of hasty goodbyes to everyone I knew at the university. I received heartfelt handshakes from Willem and Simon, and a cheerful wave from Auri. Kilvin grunted without looking up from his engraving, and told me to write down any ideas I might have for the ever-burning lamp while I was away. Arwil gave me a long, penetrating look through his spectacles and told me there would be a place for me in the Medica when I returned. Elksadal was refreshing after the other master's reserved responses. He laughed and admitted he was a little jealous of my freedom. He advised me to take full advantage of every reckless opportunity that presented itself. If 1,000 miles wasn't enough to keep my escapade secret, he said, then nothing would. I had no luck finding Elodine, and settled for sliding a note under the door of his office. Though since he never seemed to use the place, it might be months before he found it. I bought a new travel sack and a few other things a sympathist would never be without: wax, string and wire, hook, needle and gut. My clothes were easy to pack as I didn't own many. As I loaded my pack, I slowly realized I couldn't take everything with me. This came as something of a shock. For so many years, I'd been able to carry everything I've owned, usually with a hand to spare. But since I'd moved into this small garret room, I'd begun gathering oddments and half-finished projects. I now had the luxury of 2 blankets. There were pages of notes, a circular piece of half-inscribed tin from the fishery, a broken gear clock I'd taken to pieces to see if I could put it back together again. I finished loading my travel sack, then packed everything else into the trunk that sat at the foot of my bed. A few worn tools, a broken piece of slate I used for ciphering, a small wooden box with a handful of small treasures Auri had given me. Then I went downstairs and asked Anker if he would mind stowing my possessions in the basement until I returned. He admitted a little guiltily that before I'd started sleeping there, the tiny slant-ceilinged room had been empty for years and only used for storage. He was willing to leave it unrented if I promised to continue our current room for music arrangement after I returned. I gladly agreed, and swinging my loot case onto my shoulder, I headed out of the door. I wasn't entirely surprised to find Elodine on Stonebridge. Very little about the Master Namer surprised me these days. He sat on the waist-high stone lip of the bridge, swinging his bare feet over the 100-foot drop to the river below.
"Hello, Quoth,"
he said without turning his eyes from the churning water. "Hello, Master Elodine," I said.
"I'm afraid I'm going to be leaving the university for a term or two."
"Are you really afraid?" I noticed a whisper of amusement in his quiet, resonant voice. It took me a moment to realize what he was referring to.
"It's just a figure of speech. The figures of our speaking are like pictures of names. Vague, weak names, but names nonetheless. Be mindful of them."
He looked up at me.
"Sit with me for a moment."
I started to excuse myself, then hesitated. He was my sponsor, after all. I set down my loot and travel sack on the flat stone of the bridge. A fond smile came over Elodine's boyish face, and he slapped the stone parapet next to himself with the flat of his hand, offering me a seat. I looked over the edge with a hint of anxiety.
"I'd rather not, Master Elodine."
He gave me a reproachful look.
"Caution suits an arcanist. Assurance suits an aimer. Fear does not suit either. It does not suit you."
He slapped the stone again, more firmly this time. I carefully climbed onto the parapet and swung my feet over the edge. The view was spectacular, exhilarating.
"Can you see the wind?"
I tried. For a moment it seemed as if... No, it was nothing. I shook my head. Elodine shrugged nonchalantly, though I sensed a hint of disappointment.
"This is a good place for a namer. Tell me why."
I looked around.
"Wide wind, strong water, old stone."
"Good answer."
I heard genuine pleasure in his voice.
"But there is another reason. Stone, water, and wind are other places too. What makes this different?"
I thought for a moment, looked around, shook my head.
"I don't know."
"Another good answer. Remember it."
I waited for him to continue. When he didn't, I asked,
"What makes this a good place?"
He looked out over the water for a long time before he answered.
"It is an edge," he said at last. "It is a high place with a chance of falling. Things are more easily seen from edges. Danger rouses the sleeping mind. It makes some things clear. Seeing things is a part of being a namer."
"What about falling?" I asked.
"If you fall, you fall," Elodin shrugged. "Sometimes falling teaches us things too. In dreams, you often fall before you wake."
We were both silent in our thoughts for a while. I closed my eyes and tried to listen for the name of the wind. I heard the water below, felt the stone of the bridge beneath my palms. Nothing.
"Do you know what they used to say when a student left the university for a term?"
Elodin asked. I shook my head.
"They said he was chasing the wind,"
he chuckled.
"I've heard the expression."
"Have you?
What did it seem to mean?"
I took a moment to choose my words.
It had a frivolous flavour, as if students were running around to no good purpose.
Elodie nodded.
Most students leave for frivolous reasons or to pursue frivolous things.
He leaned forward to look straight down at the river below.
But that was not always the meaning of it.
No?
No.
He sat back up again.
Long ago, when all students aspired to be namers, things were different.
He licked a finger and held it to the air.
The name most fledgling namers were encouraged to find was that of the wind. After they found that name, their sleeping minds were roused, and finding other names was easier. But some students had trouble finding the name of the wind. There were too few edges here, too little risk. So they would go off into the wild, uneducated lands. They would seek their fortunes, have adventures, hunt for secrets and treasure.
He looked at me. But they were really looking for the name of the wind. Our conversation paused as someone came onto the bridge. It was a man with dark hair and a pinched face. He watched us from the corner of his eye without turning his head, and as he walked behind us, I tried not to think how easy it would be for him to push me off the bridge. Then he was past us. Elodin gave a weary sigh and continued.
Oh, things have changed. There are even fewer edges now than there were before. The world is less wild. There are fewer magics, more secrets, and only a handful of people who know the name of the wind.
You know it, don't you? I asked. Elodine nodded.
It changes from place to place, but I know how to listen for its changing shape.
He laughed and clapped me on the shoulder.
You should go. Chase the wind. Do not be afraid of the occasional risk.
He smiled.
In moderation.
I swung my legs around, hopped off the thick wall, and resettled my lute and travel sack over my shoulder. But as I started toward Imre, Elodine's voice stopped me.
Quoth!
I turned and saw Elodine lean forward over the side of the bridge. He grinned like a schoolboy.
Spit! For luck!
Devi opened the door for me and widened her eyes in shock.
My goodness,
she said, pressing a piece of paper dramatically to her chest. I recognized it as one of the notes I left under her door.
It's my secret admirer.
I was trying to pay off my loan, I said. I made 4 trips.
The walk is good for you,
she said with a cheerful lack of sympathy as she motioned me inside, bolting the door behind me. The room smelled of... I sniffed.
What is that?
I asked. Her expression went rueful.
It was supposed to be pear.
I lay down my loot case and travel sack and took a seat at her desk. Despite my best intentions, my eyes were drawn to the charred black ring. Devi tossed her strawberry blonde hair and met my eye.
Care for a rematch?
She asked, her mouth curving.
I can still take you, Gram or no Gram. I can take you while I'm dead asleep.
I'll admit to being curious, I said. But I should tend to business instead.
Very well, she said. Are you really going to pay me off entire? Have you finally found yourself a patron?
I shook my head. However, I have had a remarkable opportunity arise, the chance to get a fine patron indeed. I paused. Invintus. She raised an eyebrow.
That's a long way off, she said pointedly. I'm glad you stopped to settle your debt before jaunting off to the other side of the world. Who knows when you'll be back?
Indeed, I said. However, I find myself in a bit of an odd place, financially speaking. Devi was already shaking her head before I finished speaking.
Absolutely not. You're already into me for 9 talents. I'm not loaning you more money the day you leave town.
I held up my hands defensively.
You misunderstand,
I said. I opened my purse and spilled talents and jots onto the table. Denna's ring tumbled out too, and I stopped it before it could roll off the edge of the table. I gestured to the pile of coins in front of me, slightly more than 13 talents.
This is all the money I have in the world, I said. With it, I need to get myself to Severin with fair speed, 1,000 miles with some to spare. That means passage on at least 1 ship, food, lodging, money for coaches, or the use of a post note.
As I listed each of these things, I slid an appropriate amount of money from one side of the desk to the other. When I finally arrive in Severin, I will need to buy myself clothes that will allow me to move among the court without looking like the ragged musician I am. I slid more coins. I pointed at the few straggling coins remaining. This does not leave me with enough to settle my debt with you. Devi watched me over her steepled fingers. I see, she said seriously. We must discover some alternate method for you to square your debt. My thought is this, I said. I can leave you with collateral against my eventual return. Her eyes flickered down to the slender, dark shape of my loot case. Not my loot, I said quickly. I need that. What then? She asked. You've always said you have no collateral. I have a few things, I said, rummaging around in my travel sack, and brought up a book. Devi's eyes lit up. Then she read the spine. Rhetoric and logic? She made a face. I feel the same way, I said, but it's worth something, especially to me. Also, I reached into the pocket of my cloak and brought out my hand lamp. I have this, a sympathy lamp of my own design. It has a focused beam and a graded switch. Devi picked it up off the desk, nodding to herself. I remember this, she said. Before, you said you couldn't give it up because of a promise you'd made to Kilvin. Has that changed? I gave a bright smile that was two-thirds lie. That promise is actually what makes that lamp the perfect piece of collateral, I said. If you take this lamp to Kilvin, I have every confidence he will pay a lavish sum just to get it out of, I cleared my throat, unsavory hands. Devi flicked the switch idly with her thumb, spinning it from dim to bright and back again. And I imagine this would be a stipulation you require that I return it to Kilvin? You know me so well, I said. It's almost embarrassing. Devi set the lamp back on the table next to my book and took a slow breath through her nose. A book that's only valuable to you, she said, and a lamp that's only valuable to Kilvin. She shook her head. This is not an appealing offer. I felt a pang as I reached to my shoulder and unclasped my talent pipes and slid them onto the table as well. Those are silver, I said, and hard to come by. They'll get you into the Aeolian free, too. I know what they are. Devi picked them up and looked them over with a sharp eye. Then she pointed. You had a ring. I froze. That's not mine to give. Devi laughed. It's in your pocket, isn't it? She snapped her fingers. Come now, let me see it. I brought it out of my pocket, but I didn't hand it over. I went through a lot of trouble for this, I said. It's the ring Ambrose took from a friend of mine. I'm just waiting to return it to her. Devi sat silently, her hand outstretched. After a moment, I put the ring onto her palm. She held it close to the lamp and leaned forward, squinting one eye closed on her pixie face. That's a nice stone, she said appreciatively. The setting's new, I said miserably. Devi set the ring carefully on top of the book next to my pipes and hand lamp. Here's the deal, she said. I will keep these items as collateral against your current debt of 9 talents. This will last for the space of 1 year. A year and a day, I said. A smile curved the corner of her mouth. How storybook of you. Very well, this will postpone your repayment for a year and a day. If you have not repaid me by the end of that time, these items will be forfeit and our debt will be cleared. Her smile went sharp. Though I may be persuaded to return them in exchange for certain information. I heard the belling tower in the distance and gave a deep sigh. I didn't have much time for bargaining as I was already late for my meeting with Threep. Fine, I said, irritated, but the ring will be kept somewhere safe. You can't wear it until I've defaulted. Devi frowned. You don't. I'm not movable on this point, I said seriously. It belongs to a friend. It is precious to her. I would not have her see it on someone else's hand, not after everything I did to get it back from Ambrose. Devi said nothing, her pixie face set in a grim expression. I put on my own grim expression
and met her eye. I do a good, grim expression when I need to. A long moment of silence stretched between us.
Fine,
she said at last. We shook hands. A year and a day, I said.